No, I think we're, elites are like tiny little enzymes that affect a catalytic shift. But an enzyme is not supposed to be a major organ. It's not supposed to become the heart or the liver. But you can't live without those tiny enzymes. So a thing like Lindisfarne or Arcosani are meant to be catalytic enzymes affecting and bringing in new information and creating the conditions of transformation. But they're not supposed to be cloned and mass-produced and turned into big institutions. Lindisfarne isn't supposed to become Harvard. Arcosani isn't supposed to become, you know, Los Angeles. And if it does, then obviously it'll turn into its opposite and it'll lose its vision. One of the most important things that I've learned from looking at history is how everything turns into its opposite, that you begin with a vision and you end up with a bureaucracy. And therefore, one has to be open to the fact that when you're trying to do good, you can create the conditions of evil. And that I've studied that in countless occasions in history, but also found it happening in myself. I quit MIT and the university to set up a yogic center for the humanities. Very Catholic. I mean, the Catholics are into scholarship the way the Protestants are into social action. The Benedictines approach the love of God through the love of learning. So by trying to set up a place for the love of learning and the love of God, I was acting like very much like an ex-Roman Catholic. But what happened was it turned into its opposite, and a lot of the Lindisfarne fellows ended up working for Jerry Brown, and Jerry Brown started running for the presidency. So there was a danger that when, and I was even approached by Nelson Rockefeller when he was trying to run, so that there is a danger. What? No. Yeah, that's right. Then he went to Jimmy Carter. The Trilateral Commission. They got Zbigniew Brzezinski instead of me because I said no and I would never be any good at that. And the danger was that I could see Lindisfarne becoming its shadow. And the only way that we could deal with that was to raise it into consciousness, Tibetan Book of the Dead style. And all the Lindisfarne fellows gathered this summer on the theme of the cultural contradictions of power and what do we do if society pays attention to us because we've been used to being ignored. Because, you know, the New Alchemy Institute got a grant from the Canadian government. And by raising that into consciousness and walking through that ghost, we were able to purge it and keep Lindisfarne on the track as a center for the creation of a new culture by working with the soil of culture and working through the sacralization of culture and the sacralization of learning and the intellect and maintaining the voice of the humanities against the domination of behavioral science in all universities and elementary schools. So that what I learned from the contemplative was that if you confront your shadow, well, Alan Watts said a beautiful thing. He said, if you run away from a ghost, the ghost feeds upon your energy and chases you. If you turn and walk through the ghost, it disappears and evaporates. Because the ghost, in a sense, is related to your psychic state. If you become afraid and you generate your shadow, and I say, oh my God, Lindisfarne is becoming a hippie Trilateral Commission, then you feed that thought form and give that fantasy an illusory reality that it doesn't have. I mean, we're obviously nowhere near any resembling a hippie Trilateral Commission. On the other hand, it's a threat, it's a danger. By raising it and making it an object of meditation and practice where all the fellows come together, Paolo Soleri is one of the fellows, there are 25 of us, then we could walk through it and disperse it and release it. And so I think the political danger that was haunting us has been broken. And we're now free to return to our basic work, which in a sense is in an age in which the university, the corporation, and government have been wed together to create.
In the words of Carl Sagan, they have accumulated not speculation, but reasonably hard evidence on the extent, shape, age, contents, and ultimate fate of the entire universe. Their interest is in the largest unit of measure. While listening to this stimulating opening discussions today, I couldn't help but ask myself whether the person speaking was Big Bang or steady state. because all of us are certainly a part of that. Other physicists are concerned with atomic study and quantum mechanics, infinitesimal particles and energies, the world of the very small. Their interest is in the smallest unit of measure. Geologists' concern is the formation and structure of the Earth. Geographers' concern is the surface of the Earth. Climatologists' concern is the prevailing natural conditions on Earth: sunshine, temperature, wind, precipitation. Chemists' concern is for the composition, structure, and substance of Earth. As a group, their interest is in this planet as a site, in its structure, in its materials, and in its conditioning. The Earth is our unit of measure. Botanists' concern is plant life, zoologists, animal life, biologists, living organisms, ecologists, the interrelationships of organisms and their environment. Their group interest is in harmonious existence and coexistence of life forms as a unit of measure. Anthropologists' concern is Homo sapiens. Sociologists' concern is societies, social institutions, and social relationships. Psychologists' concern is mental and behavioral characteristics. Their group interest in general is humans as a unit of measure. My point is excellence of performance and the dedication of many people in many scientific disciplines using many units of measure over many years' time have built a very large body of knowledge about Earth and vicinity, its given conditions and its life forms, the natural context environment, has been rather clearly defined. Now, what about Homo sapiens? What has he, she done to this wondrous affair with all this knowledge? Modern version Homo sapiens has, for the most part, almost completely failed to understand that this knowledge must be used as the generator for any harmonious modification of Earth for human purpose. Without mass dedication to this thesis, there will be little excellence in the design of built environment. The fact of the matter is that most of the built environment is not even designed at all, or if so, not seriously. It happens because material gain is the prime motivator and the unit of measure. In the main, professionals, and I speak primarily of professionals in my own field, which is architecture, who profess concern and have opportunity and ability to actually do something, seem to be preoccupied with style as an end in itself. It's an international disease. These people play highly esoteric games among themselves, sacrificing concern for an organic and cohesive whole. They sacrifice this for very private ego images. There is a real preoccupation with it in our current society. And imagery will never be a substitute for vision. One must ask if most professionals are really seriously seeking as individuals that inner balance so necessary to a person to selfishly search for a human environment. Excellence doesn't seem to be the goal, and dedication is not the stance. The ego is in the way, It has become the unit of measure. And as I see it, it is quite insufficient to cope with the larger forces at work in the environment. Sadly enough, that small percentage for whom the human as unit of measure has deeper meaning and who have the wisdom and ability to shape a human environment seldom or never have that opportunity. They may struggle responsibly and relentlessly with dedication to the excellence of the vision of a higher level of human consciousness and a human environment in sympathy with such a desire as a real objective. But theirs is a well-nigh impossible task. However, pessimism is not the order of the day, nor is it the tone of my thoughts. At a festival, optimism and the sense of joy should prevail. What I have been saying really is in the past, or at most present. There is the future, and with it, in my mind, comes hope. And hope lies in the young. In recent years, one senses a new maturity in youth. Some basic change has occurred. The human brain and mind has evolved to that point where intelligent young people have become aware that a more inclusive and more comprehensive approach to dealing with the environmental issues that are crystallized by anyone's interface with both the natural order and his or her fellow beings is necessary. It is requisite that as individuals, they are cognitive of and order in their own minds the complexity of measuring units now in use in society. Then they must simplify. They possess the ability to do so in increasingly large numbers. And we must strive to assure that their behavior will be responsible, and that they will know and respect their earth, and that dedication to excellence in achieving a human environment can only be developed in harmony and communion with the natural order. And we must try to influence them in making this choice. Thank you.
I think some of you are being blinded by the sun. Would you like to move over to one side or the other? Or face this way or that way? Okay. My name is Peter Blake, and I'm chairman of the School of Architecture, the Boston Architectural Center, and I'm an architect as well. I thought that I'd like to talk about these two concepts, excellence and commitment, by reading a short part of an article that appeared in the Boston Globe about a week ago. And it said, it was Dateline Washington, "The Department of Housing and Urban Development is shutting down its New Towns program, putting an end to a sad," that's in quotes, "sad, painful, and expensive effort," unquote, "to build innovative new communities throughout the nation. The new communities effort is one of the best publicized failures of all federal urban programs. One official, declining to be identified, said its reputation was so low that, quote, we didn't want to tarnish the urban policy, unquote, with the New Towns initiative. Losses in the 8-year New Communities program now total $149 million. And the Office of Management and Budget has refused to release planning funds to revive the program. Then goes on to say, after a lot of blah, 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 the department will try to sell off most of the 7 projects it's liquidating. These projects are in Jonathan, Minnesota, perhaps the best known of the new towns, as well as Park Forest South in Chicago, Cedar Riverside in Minneapolis, Flower Mound near Dallas, Texas, Riverton and Gananda near Rochester, New York, and Newfields near Dayton, Ohio. Now, I think that we who are sitting in one of the most interesting new towns in the world today, or in the beginnings of one, should comment on this announcement, which frankly I welcome. I think perhaps new towns should not have been built, should not have been planned by the feds to start with, but in any case, the failure has now been recognized and the losses are being liquidated. And if any of you want to buy a used new town, you have to write to Ms. Patricia Harris, who is the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development in Washington, D.C. There are two examples, perhaps, of the issue of excellence in architecture and urban design, and the issue of excellence and the issue of commitment. To most of us who are architects, the person who has been most influential in the formulation of ideas and so on in the past 10, 15 years has been a man called Robert Venturi in Philadelphia. And Mr. Venturi, whose books are very well known, whose buildings are quite well known too, is, of course, famous for his statement that Main Street, USA, is almost all right. He is famous for having, in effect, said that the way to deal with the urban problem in America is to join mid-cult America, to join middle America, to join Main Street, and to emulate, in fact, what Main Street and the Strip at Las Vegas and Levittown, New York, and other communities of that sort have done. He himself happens to be an extremely sophisticated person, a very scholarly man, a very excellent architect. And it seems to me, although I'm very fond of him and I admire his intellect, it seems to me that it is an incredibly condescending attitude for an intellectual and a person who might very well in another time have been committed to excellence to say to the rest of the population, let them eat bread. If that's what they want, you know, let's give it to them. Let's give them Main Street, let's give them storefronts, let's give them the back of the A&P. That's what they want, that's what they'll get. That, it seems to me, is not a commitment to excellence of the kind that architects in the past have had, that most of us, I think, still believe in. It seems to me to be a commitment to the kind of middle American streetscape, the kind of middle American mentality that the Nixon administration was so very much in tune with, that other recent administrations have been in tune with. It does not, to me, seem to be a very valid, a very respectful way of treating your fellow men and fellow women. That is one, however, one enormously powerful point of view today, a point of view that is gaining adherence everywhere, that is saying, in effect, we can't do anything with American cities anyway, in American suburbs, they're uniformly awful, or worse, so let's just try to fit in and do the best we can under the circumstances. The other kind of commitment, the other kind of dedication is, I think, exemplified in this place here. I've known Paolo for about 25 years or more, and the last time I was here was about 5 years ago, and the place was had a few foundation walls and one or two of the arches. It has what you see here today was built with incredible selflessness, incredibly hard work on the part of a great many people, with tremendous dedication, with a tremendous commitment to an ideal. And I think there is nothing in my mind other than total admiration for what has been achieved here and what I'm sure will be achieved in the years to come. I received a statement which I think Paolo read in part earlier this morning. I received it a few days ago, and in it is a sentence in which he points out that It should be the declared intentional determinant pursuit. It should be the declared intentional policy, I guess, of public authorities to foster, to support the determined pursuit of exotic ideas which offer the opportunity of testing, verifying, and assessing notions, systems, and situations now, which may well become run-of-the-mill in the next century, 20 years or so away. He makes the point that in a in today's America, there are no alternative lifestyles being developed in terms of new towns, in terms of new communities. And this may very well be the only one. I happen to disagree with him slightly. I also think that there's one other new town in America that I find interesting. That's Disney World in Orlando, but perhaps that isn't a completely relevant case in point. However, having said all kinds of things and really deep admiration about this place, I want to bring up the one issue which obviously is being made by everyone who knows about Akwesasne, everyone who's been here, everyone who will be here. And that is this in fact an answer to the problems of urban design, of city planning, of survival of cities in America? Or is this an escapist solution, a way of getting away from it all, a way of escaping all the nasty, unpleasant, vulgar problems that all of our cities face? I've never lived in this kind of environment before. I've always lived in cities like New York and now in Boston. I find it very difficult to relate the kind of thing that I see here to anything other than perhaps a very, very beautiful Shangri-La, a very beautiful place far removed from the real problems of the real world, the racial problems, the economic problems, the terrible problems of pollution, the terrible problems of mechanisms, of functional organisms that no longer work. I raise this really as a question because it is a question that is being asked of everyone. And Paolo and I have talked about it in the past. I'm sure that all of you have brought it up at one time or another. I raise it simply because I think that's what we ought to be talking about, one of the things that we ought to be talking about. So I think at this point I'll stop and pass the microphone to Jeff Cook.
Keep the groups separate. Yes, we have a rather unbalanced panel with three architects and a sculptor. I'm Jeff Cook from the College of Architecture at Arizona State University. And of course, it's very easy for us to look at the surroundings that we're in at the moment as a kind of model, as a kind of test of whatever the issues are that we think are troubling the world. And we hope to find if goodness is expressed in terms such as excellence and commitment, then potentially we hope to find those things here. I guess I find that a little bit troublesome. I'm not ready or willing to pass judgment on this place in one sense or another. In fact, I'm sort of amused that professionals often speak about the thing that they do to earn a living as practice. And I tend to think that that's what this is, that this is practice, that this is a first stroke, that it's a sketch. And I think personally that it would be very wrong for us to look on this as having any finality in terms of suggesting solutions or conclusions to urbanity or to the built environment. I was going to play the devil's advocate, but I think I've already been sort of upstaged. I was going to, at one stage, sort of propose that we should talk about the opposite of excellence and commitment, that we should talk about mediocrity, and that we should talk about the second class. Ron Gurley told us that excellence was first class. And I think that really is an important issue to raise, though, is what sort of culture do we live in, and is excellence prized? Is commitment respected? The times and place that we live in, I'm not sure that those goody-goody goals have much significance, that they have much weight with the ordinary person. And I've heard it alluded to more than once today, the kind of comment that smacked of ego trips and elitism. And this is really difficult because professionals, by definition, ought to be able to do something better than somebody else. And thereby, they set themselves apart. And there we get this excellence and commitment. Incidentally, I tend to think that the commitment ought to come before the excellence. Well, against these kinds of thought, I've wondered what kind of a proposal I might make with respect to the issue of art and the environment and the opportunity to be able to speak together. And it seemed to me that it might be better to suggest not an architectural or sculptural or musical solution, but rather to suggest a more personal kind of a direction. And maybe it's not so much a solution as a kind of resolution of the frustrations of our time. I wonder whether the pursuit of excellence and the question of planning for the future shouldn't begin with ourselves, with some kind of, as Ron Gurley mentioned, a return to the natural order, whether it shouldn't be directed toward a reexamination of ourselves and our personal lives. I happen to be involved very heavily in solar energy and the issues of energy applications to buildings and the rest of our built environment. And I really get turned off by the many professionals who make a lot of noise in those many fields, and then they go out and jump in their big car and go home to a life which seems to be so completely at odds to their daily commitment. And I sense that that kind of fracturing, that lack of integrity, is evident in more professions than those people who are involved in solar. And so I would prefer to avoid looking at the aesthetic as an isolated issue. I wonder whether we couldn't move all of us, both you and I, toward some sort of concept of life itself as an art form. The idea that, first of all, one must get his own house in order, his own personal life, and then secondly, obviously, this hopefully can be expanded to become a kind of communal responsibility. So this double-barreled responsibility, first to self and then communal, has to do with both maintenance and enhancement. In terms of maintenance, we all do all this stuff all the time. You know, we get up in the morning, and that in itself is sometimes an incredible act. It's not very often an artistic act. The little acts of grooming, and I suppose act is maybe a good word to use, can these not be the basis for just a little bit of sublimation? Then there's the business of fueling ourselves, of energizing ourselves with food. Do we feed or do we dine? There's the daily maintenance of our mind and its expansion and stimulation. There's the parallel for our bodies. The business of maintaining and hopefully enhancing the resilience of the physical thing that sort of carries the rest of us around. The current popularity with jogging, of course, is a kind of very popular attempt to roll all of that into one particular discipline. And then these are just ways of looking at self. The art of living, though, really has to do with sharing. It has to do with the enhancement and the incremental improvement of the time that we live in. And here is where service and where sharing with others becomes a much larger kind of fulfillment. Well, that's the kind of what. It's an idea that maybe all of us ought to be more artist. All of us ought to have more integrated lives. There are other issues which are perhaps a lot easier to face. The where, all of us are someplace. And one of the observations I would make about the 20th century is the kind of nomadic civilization that we live in. One of the things about industrialization is that it is nomadic, that it is totally universal in its availability, and even cultural attributes increasingly have a kind of instant replay potential. Well, this then gives us a special kind of frame of reference, because in effect we need to develop disciplines of integrity that can travel, that can survive, and that can persevere in a materialistic and nomadic setting. Traditionally, cultures that had integrity were very locally based. They had a place, they had a focus. And I think that certainly is one of the fracturing aspects of the life we have now. We seldom, it seems we seldom settle in one spot long enough to get our act together. And lastly, one might examine the hows of this kind of program. Again, I'm afraid I have a very modest kind of suggestion. It seems to me that it not only takes the sort of dedication and commitment that's already been described, but that, it takes a particular focus, a particular direction. It takes concentration and it takes specialization. If I could use an architectural analogy, the Parthenon, which has often been acclaimed, was really built three times. And obviously the third time was better than the second, and the second time was better than the first. But the concept of a Greek temple, which is epitomized in the kind of approach to perfection that the Parthenon represents, was not a new invention with that building. That was a building type that had been practiced. And here we come back again to some of my earlier words, the use of the word practice, for a series of centuries. So that with that kind of continuous dedication to a certain theme, there was an approach to perfection. So those are a few thoughts which I would very much appreciate some interaction on.
Okay. My name is Chris Robinson. I'm a sculptor from South Carolina. And I came in here on very short notice, and I spent most of my time here being involved with that commitment of finishing the work that I came here to do. In fact, every time I glance out at the window and see the sun setting, I keep getting this feeling that I should be outside working. So, in spending my time, or my commitment on my work, I came somewhat ill-prepared for this panel. And I've been sitting here and joked with the panelists at first that I'd listen and hopefully go last and hopefully find something that offended me sufficiently to get my dander up and have something to talk about for a while. Well, I listened and listened and listened, and I've listened to these panels before, and I was disappointed that nothing came about that really offended me.
We could try again.
Okay, I'm hoping now that I'm setting you up, but. Then I turned to the next alternative. I tried to think of something that I could use sufficiently offend the other panelists. And what strikes me as somewhat even sadder is I couldn't even come up with that. I really feel in some ways like the odd man out. I tried to figure the similarities, the idea of dealing with space, and I tried to figure the differences, and I kept coming up with stagnant old things like form and function, things like that. That's what I was just going to say, essentially, that I can sit here and try and give you some description of why I'm here, but I don't think that's really fair for the panel, and there'll be an opportunity for that tomorrow. But after setting up all these suggestions and having high hopes and not really any answers, perhaps, as was suggested earlier, the best thing is, unless there are some other immediate comments, to turn to you and hope that one of you can sufficiently offend me or us into some more stimulating discussion.
Okay. Well, this is depressed. Don't want to mention anything about communities in terms of excellent architecture commitment. Mr. Cook here. Now I'm wondering, you could aid
Let me answer this as honestly as I can. I think that architects in a capitalist society are in very bad trouble, because most of the time the person who hires them, for whom they work, or the authority or the people who hire them, are not the users. And yet the dialogue that architects want to engage in should be and is, I mean, architects want to engage in a dialogue with the users, with the future users, or the close facsimile thereof. And yet, the people they seem to be responsible to are people who may never use any of the structures or cities or communities at all. I think that this is a very, very serious dilemma, and has been for architects for many generations in any society which is not, in effect, a socialist society. And how it might work, whether it might work out differently in an ideal socialist society, I don't know. But in recent years, as you know, it has been very difficult for clients to impose their buildings on the users, and so the pressure from user groups, from beginning with the people that Jane Jacobs organized and so on, you know, has been sufficiently great so that architects have been able to work with the users of their buildings rather than with the clients, the people who pay the bills. And I think, by and large, this has improved the end product immeasurably. But I think the preference on the part of most architects is to work with the users, with the communities that they mean to serve.
One of my favorite people, I never really met him, but was about to just before he died, was Jef Schumacher. And I know you're familiar with his small is beautiful philosophy. The conditions in the world of building the environment today are such that since the almighty dollar is the standard of measure, very large machines which turn out plans for buildings for corporations in a very impersonal kind of way, are the order of the day. And one can see in cities like Boston, or even in some of the European cities now, which used to be dignified by church towers as the prime visual element, are now dignified by banks and insurance companies, and profit, money-making, material gain is the motivation which is shaping today's environment. And that kind of idealistic, wonderful kind of relationship that we want to think of between architect and client doesn't exist, and it will not exist until these great machines are destroyed, until the society itself rises and says that if we want to have a fine environment, we are going to have to break down. And many people working on small-scale things will make a fine built environment, but under the conditions that we have today, there will be no such thing.
If we could pursue this question a little bit, because while we approach the subject of mediocrity with tongue-in-cheek, I think we've already had two readings from two eminent educators that the marketplace is not interested in excellence, that architects are indeed looked on as service personnel for business aspirations. And I wonder if there is anything we have to say about what turns, let's say, the commitment of prospective architects, young students who enter architectural schools, and the kind of transformation as they gradually realize the kind of real world that they must face as a prospective professional.
Would you like me to?
Yes, I sure would.
I'm not quite sure I agree with your interpretation of what I said, but you're quite right in saying that in the world as it is now in this country, architects are considered service personnel to a client who may very well be a Rockefeller or whatever. I mean, the most grotesque example of building for a client rather than the users is the Albany Mall in upstate New York, in Albany, New York, where the client was Nelson Rockefeller, period. One man. He got the money for it, and he was the one who had to be satisfied. His ego had to be satisfied. The tens of thousands of people who are working there now were never considered, never asked, never interviewed, never polled. Neither were the tens of thousands of people who were displaced when that fascist construction took place. It's quite true that architects are considered service personnel today in this country. But I think that at the same time, the two things that are happening are, first, the thing that I mentioned already, that the community groups are beginning to feel their strength, they're beginning to resist, and they're beginning to insist on being consulted. The second thing is that my point was not that architects, that people didn't want excellence. That may be true or it may not be true. My point is that architects who think that they do have a sense of quality of what buildings should be like should try to set examples of excellence. I mean, if I overheard a couple of doctors say, my God, give him junk food, you know, it'll probably kill him, but that's what he wants, I would not have very much confidence in those doctors. And that is the kind of talk that goes on among a good many architects today, you know, who say, Main Street is almost all right, let's build Main Street. So that was my point. My point was not that we should abdicate from trying to set examples. I'm sorry, I've talked much too much.
Do you have any thoughts?
Well, it's. I think the young people, and that's, I really have confidence in them to do something about this. And one of the points I was trying very much to make was that they should not be spending their time working with the ego images of some people who happen to be successful practicing architects today. They really should be going after the basics, and they really should be finding out about their Earth and what the life on it really is, and how from that kind of a basis, an architecture of meaning and a built environment can come that will be something different than we have now. To me, that's the exciting thing about being in the world of building an architecture, that everything still lies ahead, because to this point, practically nothing has been done that has substance or will remain. And they ask us very frequently, I'm the dean of the College of Architecture at the University of Arizona, and they ask me, why are you training so many architects? The market is overloaded already. We don't need them. But who is saying that? The practitioners who run big plan mills are saying that. Man is by nature a building animal. And to him falls the responsibility of modifying and altering the Earth's surface. And that is an awesome responsibility in my mind. And large numbers of young people need to grow up understanding what these real issues are about environment and not be misled and drawn away by flashy images and superficial, catchy kinds of things. That's why I talked about the preoccupation with style, that this is nonsense. This is not going to lead us to an architecture or an environment or a community of any quality of any kind where excellence and dedication are issues.
Lady here who wanted to.
Yes. Several of you have alluded to individual things, people who change the trend of reality, and yet do architects or the architects that you work with encourage individuals rather than the large corporations, because communities really begin with individuals, and I think Arco Santi is particularly a community of individuals. Having been built that way.
Are you?
I really don't get that there's a lot of encouragement from architects for individual excellence.
Well, the group is made up of individuals, and each of us is born an individual and will always be an individual, and each of us has to face the issue of measuring him or herself against the natural order and against fellow human beings. And fellow human beings measuring themselves against each other create scenes very frequently. But a self-sacrifice of some kind, a rising above the superficial ego to the point of getting in touch with one's real deep ego, is it's an issue for everyone in society today, not just architects. And these kinds of things happen not in a short period of time, but people like Carl Sagan once again are dealing with the evolution of the human brain, the understanding, the sense of a new level of consciousness developing, in which some of the kinds of things that we're talking about, I think, have a much better chance of occurring. But the individual human being is the real unit of measure in life. The degree to which individual beings come together because of their desire for things like excellence and because of their dedication to things will evolve into the possibility of a finer environment for us.
Maybe I could reply in a different way, speaking about the profession. I think I would agree with the observation that architects, at least in this country, seem not to be terribly responsive to the public at large, nor potentially to issues of excellence. And maybe that's one of the reasons why we're here to do something about it. I would make an observation that the architectural profession doesn't behave the same way everywhere, and in particular in England, where I've had some experience. Over the last generation or so, the architectural profession has made itself more or less indispensable to society. It has made society, and in that case that mostly has to do with collective governmental agencies, believe that architects are really necessary to the society.
This is in England.
In England. I'm speaking about Britain. And thereby, there is a great deal more interaction and interresponsibilities between the profession and the public at large. I don't know whether I could say that the built environment it is discernibly better yet, but it seems to me that that at least is one situation which may have some promise. If I were to make excuse for American architects, it would be that they do, after all, have to live in the same kind of value system that everyone else lives in, and they can very easily starve themselves if they don't match the needs of the society. And there goes the excellence right out the window. They are controlled by the people who pay the tune. I wonder what our sculptor has to say about this kind of dilemma. How'd you get your bread?
Well, it's interesting to me that you suggest that let the people take over and control the shape of architecture. I, as somebody else in the audience mentioned, think that would be an interesting idea to pursue, but if it's such a good idea, why isn't it done? I mean, the potential certainly exists to do it.
Well, this also begins to address the question of, and I haven't found out who's for and who's against yet, but the question of elitists versus looking at whole societies, looking at set pieces of art versus looking at whole environments.
Some other day. Yeah. I think there's some. There's some. Yes.
It seems to me that the
Bauhaus
movement
industry, learn from the national community, on the best of the
you guys is, I think, the most clear. We are low right now. We better start thinking about tomorrow. Let's change our schools. Let's change the disability of our minds. Let's become educated students. If we really believe we are not, we can design a better world, we can design a better environment, we must share that with others. See, we can't believe in the power. We talk to ourselves. We must start talking not at the end of the world, this petition of the petition. We must try. We just heard this arrangement about someone who's saying to us, well, you know what they want. First, talking about doctors. Also, either way is wrong. We must enlighten the community. Tell them what we can do. We can say, we can do a tremendous amount of things at the time. I think it's a wonderful example. No one here owns this land to expand, to extend, even speculation. And I think that the last time for us to say whether we will assume a responsibility. And we are. We just work for that. Not a lot of people work for bosses or companies to do what you want. But then if you don't have to think so much great about it, you'll have to be able to.
There are always happy instances. I don't think that one should get the idea that we're completely pessimistic, but there are many citable occasions where architect, client, or community have really made very good contributions. There's another question back there.
Yes,
sir.
Let me try to answer, and I think we, after that, we probably have to quit this room. I was using that term, working with the user, in some metaphorical sense. For example, many times, take a dormitory, a student dormitory at a university. Obviously, you're not going to be able to talk to the people who are going to be there in 5 years from now, or 10 years from now. But there is a great difference between working with the buildings and grounds department of the university, which is staffed by a bunch of idiots most of the time, who paint everything green and number every door, you know, which is their only interest, and working and really talking to students and finding out how students like to live. Now, in Boston, where Ron used to live and I still do, there is a dormitory, as many of you know, by Aalto, which was done in 1948, in which almost every room, every student room, is slightly different from every other room. Now, that was an incredibly radical idea and an extremely sensitive perception on the part of Aalto, because he realized that students don't want to be treated like numbers. At the same time, before then and since then, thousands of student dormitory rooms in the greater Boston area have been built by people who've never talked to anyone, have been designed by architects who've never talked to anyone except the buildings and grounds people at Harvard and MIT and so on. So I think it's a, I was using the term user in a metaphorical sense. You know, if you talk to the kinds of people who are going to be using it, the kinds of people as widely as possible, rather than to your clients, I think that's, anyway, I think we have to leave. Thank you very much.
I think you can find in all traditional societies that what we call doctors, medical men, are not really isolated practitioners that look only after the body. In most traditional societies, you have the conception of the medicine man, the healer, who is much more than the man who is trying to repair part of your body when it is worn up. He is a man who is trying to see how you have got out of the equilibrium of things. What is the relation of the human being to his entire field of forces, and how this whole system got out of balance. So the role of culture in this process is to promote continuous reintegration, is to promote and enhance process of harmony. And this has been so in all traditional societies and in our society. I think culture does it symbolically by trying to invent various codes and various interactive messages whereby by symbolic relationship we get into harmony with ourselves and with the rest of the universe. In terms of physical processes, we have all the quantitative measures whereby a body is kept in equilibrium. But on the social and cultural level, there are those more subtle symbolic interactions which culture takes care of, sometimes marvelously well and without much awareness of what, of our awareness, what it is doing. Instead of rambling, I'll just try to read one or two paragraphs which summarize my position, which is to say that the idea of culture as healer designates a process whereby the individual is psychically and spiritually renewed by it, when at the same time he positively contributes to it. Culture as healer thus works in two ways: by transmitting to us the invisible psychic energy which makes us feel to belong at home, at one with ourselves and at one with other human beings. And I think this environment that has been created here is as good an example as any of certain built-in forms that have more than physical shapes to them, that have certain symbolic significance. The forms that work on us and the form that we find conducive and enhancing. I think my case really would rest on your experience of this environment and your realization whether and in what sense this is a healing environment, whether in what sense man does not live by bread and butter alone, but those subtle spiritual interactions. What is it in the nature of those environments which are rich spiritually and culturally that makes us feel good, that makes us feel somehow healed and mended? What is it in this environment that makes us feel good? And I think the introspection of this process of experience would reveal that this is a peculiar kind of healing process whereby many of the processes of disintegration of us as cultural beings have been somehow mended. So I'll finish reading this bit by suggesting that secondly, by challenging us to contribute to it, and by engaging and absorbing us into its own life. Both processes have a healing power, for without them, the individual becomes morose, deranged, schizophrenic. In short, we are a part of the life of culture, and culture is an intrinsic part of our life. Put otherwise, culture shapes the individual who in turn contributes to the ethos of the culture. So we are aware that we are complex and fragile systems, vulnerable all the time to the processes of entropy, both physical and psychic. Our body, that is, the life process and life processes in our body combat this tendency to entropy by continuously reintegrating what entropy wants to dissolve. Our minds and our psychic life are subject to ceaseless entropy as well. Culture and the processes it generates are par excellence integrative. I think this is one of the most characteristic of culture from my point of view. It is integrative on the psychological, cultural and psychic level. They are constantly rebuilding what entropy wants to dissolve. In yet another formulation, culture as healer signifies the anti-entropic qualities of culture, which keeps constantly rebuilding the structures of our psychic and spiritual life. When man's spiritual life is gone, the human being is, in a significant sense, dead. As you may be aware, the old-fashioned expression that culture is, quote, the nourishment of the soul, on this definition is not far from the truth. If by soul we mean the variety of psychic energy that man transacts with his culture and other human beings, then the expression is exactly right. Well, if such is the case, let us look very briefly historically at a contemporary scene and see where we are and what has gone wrong. As you are aware, in this remarkable book, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, Robert Percy claims that our age is somehow defunct and crippled because it lacks of quality. In my opinion, it is because it lacks of spirituality. Or my second thesis is that it is the spiritual substance of culture that keeps it nourishing in the life. And it's because we have somehow purged ourselves of spiritual content during the last two centuries that we find our culture not nourishing. The process really started in the post-Renaissance times, but really in a big way with the evolution of the mechanistic worldview, with the idea of the cosmos as a clock-like mechanism. In perfecting this metaphor of the universe as a clock-like mechanism, we have continually, that is during the last two centuries, tried to eliminate all the elements of the universe that somehow didn't belong to the mechanistic metaphor, that were not expressible through physical laws. As a result, we have purged all non-physical elements, first from physics, then from chemistry, then from physiology, then in the 19th century from psychology, and then at the end of the 19th century, in the 20th century, from culture and from art in particular. For the pursuit of secularism meant chasing out all the gods and by the same token all the spiritual and transcendental forces from it. It has been an unfortunate coincidence or a mistake of the pursuit of the mechanistic worldview that while trying to liberate ourselves from the constraining aspects of religion, we attributed to religion not only those defunct aspects of it, but also all spiritual and transcendental functions. So we have eliminated not only the tyranny of religion, but also a great deal of transcendental and spiritual content that have gone with the practice and then the worship of religion. As a result, particularly in the second half of the 19th century, we have increasingly impoverished our art and our culture. From the standpoint of the history of art, we see from 19th century on, the late 19th century on, the progressive liberation of the artist from form. First from classical form in music, in painting, in sculpture, and then from all form, so that in the 20th century, anything goes. Anything goes, but at the same time, one has to realize that while liberating ourselves from the constraints of traditional culture, we have liberated art from what it was always renowned for, from being a carrier of spiritual substance, spiritual message. And I think the plight of modern art, particularly the second half of the 20th century art, the plight of the avant-garde is really exactly in proportion to its abandoning its role as carrier of spiritual substance, as the conveyor of cultural values which have maintained our sanity and our well-being for such a long time. And no wonder that there is almost universal revulsion to modern art, for modern art is particularly anti-healing. If we are really reacting against it, I think it is for good reason. For our instinct tells us that it is not art that somehow integrates, that is wholesome. For modern art, somehow on purpose, assaults us and disintegrates us. In my opinion, if we are going to survive as integrated human beings, there must be some symbolic modes that do it for us. Art in this second half of the 20th century somehow relegated and renounced its role as healer. And so far nothing has emerged in its place. To rephrase the point through the words of Goethe, who once said that to treat man as he is to debase him. To treat man as he ought to be is to engrace him. Traditional religions and traditional art treated man as he ought to be. Philosophies from the Renaissance on, and particularly from the 18th century on, particularly in the 19th and the 20th century, and inspired by Marxism, by positivism, by secularism, increasingly treated man as he is, and increasingly debased him. So our agenda now is to, again, treat man as he ought to be, and to refuse culture with spiritual substance, which it has lost. And what I feel as exciting, and what I feel is happening here, is that somehow, in spite of the seeming impossibility of doing so, we have been able to, again, resurrect this old-fashioned concept of man, who is made not only of clay, but of stars. And our pursuit here is the pursuit of excellence in the term of treating man as he ought to be, and therefore engracing him. And this has been always the most important aspect of culture. And this is why culture has been healer. And this is why I insist that unless we are somehow able to recapture symbolic significance of healing process of culture, we are going to be in trouble, and we are in trouble. As you know, during the last 15 years, the number of mentally ill patients that has increased in the United States 400%. And I'm told that half of the beds are occupied by mentally deranged persons. And I think if we really look at large as a very perturbed mental scene of our times, at so many people being at a loose end, in my opinion, it is the result of the culture that has been unable to somehow glue people spiritually, that has been able to provide the nourishment, which may be not quantifiable, not empirical, not physical, but yet all important. So we are sick people because we have a sick culture somehow deprived of spirituality. And this is a few comments I want to share with you. Well, actually, Plato was already of this opinion that our and yet, although they are all new, they function in the same kind of universal way that your nose is for sneezing, your eye for seeing, and also it is recognizable your nose and your eyes. Well, I mean, whatever they say, granted that they say it, what follows from it? I think that I don't know, and I think that we don't know, and I think that whatever arguments have been provided so far are clearly unsatisfactory. I think that I can provide one significant clue by pointing out that many people have suddenly died after retirement, when they retired in full strength, and suddenly they found that they had nothing significant to do, and the whole spirit has withered. Also that the number of deaths of spouses after one of the spouses died during the first 6 months is phenomenal. So one can die of grief, which means again that it is not only the nourishment, the physical aspect, but all other symbolic aspects of our interaction with other human beings that are all important. Beyond that, I think I can speculate as well as you can. But I think that certain coherence and meaning to life is very necessary to go on. And again, another example, how much examples can prove, I don't know. There was a famous case of a man who was blind from birth and gained sight after an operation at the age of 40. And he was fantastically thrilled and really excited at first. Sure enough, sometimes he would have to touch objects in order to see them. However, after 6 months, he found that this was not so exciting. After 9 months, he found that he was getting increasingly bored. And after 15 months, without any reason, he died. I know that those examples do not answer your question, and yet in a kind of funny way they may. You had a question out there? Well, look at the stars first and at your navel next, while most of the time we just do it the other way around. And indeed, sometimes and often we never see the stars. I think that the problem is really a deep one, because I do not particularly blame this culture or this generation for what is happening in the States at present. It is a result of a long process. It was a progressive mechanization of the cosmos, progressive instrumentalization of the universe through instruments of power, whereby we were supposed to gain domination over it all and become rational. And therefore, we didn't need any spurious trapping on religion and art for rationality. Science and technology was going to do it all for us. And this pursuit of power, of control, of manipulation, has been really intoxicating for the European mind for at least 2 centuries. And then we found that there is a limit to it. And indeed that there is a kind of dialectical limit to it, that after we have saturated our world with certain instruments of power, they are backfiring. And the dream of happiness and the dream of fulfillment by sheer power of manipulation is really turning into nightmare. And therefore, the process is to rethink it de novo, to rethink what are our myths, what are our underlying assumptions, what are our ideals. And you will have to realize that it is because we have emptied our cosmos of what all other cultures assumed to be the case. As Marshall Salin says in his book, culture as a practical, whatever it is, practical and practical reason, we are the only people who think that they descended from the beast. All others think they descended from gods. I think there is a significant point to be taken. For all other people think that the universe, the nature, is endowed with this power beyond physical, that it somehow reverberates with spiritual transcendental power. And we have to re-sacralize, in a sense, the cosmos around us in order to find our destiny for ourselves and in order to feel that we are reunited with the stars again, and then I think we will have much less difficulties of finding particular goals for ourselves. For we find those goals so very difficult because our universe is so very enclosed and really we are trapped. When we open our universe, there will be so many causes and our destiny will be united with so many other forces that you will never really ask those kinds of questions. You wanted to continue, yeah? To treat men and women as she ought to be, and beyond what he or she is. Because treating ourselves as we are is really treating us wrongly, not giving enough scope for what we may become if we really try to reach the stars. We have just started it. We are just doing it. Tomorrow morning, before I worry about my problem with my students, with my deans, with my girlfriends, or whatever, I'll look at the beauty of this canyon and will remark to myself how incredible it is to be able to see, how incredible it is to interact with those elements, how incredible it is to perceive and somehow transform creatively environment. This is on the personal level, to realize the utter uniqueness of our being in this universe, and to realize that we are a repository of fantastic endowment of life and fantastic endowment of human genius through generations and millennia, which we are often squandering by changing it into those disposable goods, and then really by maintaining the dialogue with other human beings, not on the level of our biological and economic being, but on the level of our transcendental being, and on yet another level by trying to reformulate all those dogmas and assumptions which we make about the world and ourselves, often under the auspices of philosophers that try to serve man as he is. As you know, for quite a while, particularly in the 60s, there was a number of theories justifying our greed, our selfishness by alleged aggressive nature of man. And there were many of such books. Now suddenly anthropologists turn around and say, well, this is really a superficial reading. Leakey, who is really one of the greatest of anthropologists, by examining the remnants of those homoids some 2 million years ago, came to the conclusion and suggested strongly that our ancestor of 2 million ago was a very gentle and cooperative creature. And this theories of aggression is somehow a kind of manipulated outcome of trying to justify the practice of our society. And this is one of the rethinking. And then we don't have to apologize for wanting to be altruistic, for wanting to be compassionate, for wanting to embrace each other, for wanting to reach the stars. And this rethinking will be very important and really tremendously important, so that we find new premises and new philosophies that will justify, among other things, what we are doing here and what we are doing in weak moments. And those things have to go on simultaneously. Chris has a point. I think the effects are what I have already tried to sketch. We try to suppress our noble impulses by thinking that we are foolish and romantic, and at the same time trying to somehow develop, which is really very much encouraged by schools and the whole structure of society, those aggressive and competitive instincts. And by this token, we polarize the whole scene. I can see it among my students. In the late 60s and early 70s, the whole thing somehow loosened up and they started to evolve into alternative modes. After the economic crunch came, they are again struggling with each other really hard to raise their grade by one decimal point, and they are really inflicting pain on themselves. They are really perpetuating the wrong myth that it is all a matter of objective attainment. It's all a matter of raising a grade by decimal point. It's all a matter of outdoing each other, all a matter of knifing, really, each other by saying that I am better than you are and therefore I can outdo it. I think this is the kind of competitive ladder which capitalist system wants to perpetuate, for it is based on the assumption that, you know, it is a jungle and therefore either you or I, without realizing that this idiom has proved bankrupt for the system itself. And consequently, our justification of new philosophies which put a new light on man and our behavior, which try to justify that it's all right to be gentle, it's all right to be loving, it's all right to be caring, it's all right to be compassionate to each other, that this is really not something that only sissies who cannot make it in the other world are indulging in, but this is in the nature of things, that it is congruent with the order of things. It may be congruent with the larger evolution of man. But I think rethinking those propositions and rewiring our mind, our assumptions, our dispositions, our behavior, is tremendously important. For so much, so we feel, so many of us, so good here, because we do not have to be on the defensive. We do not have to fight. We do not have to compete. However, once we leave here, we put the shield on and struggle again. And I think that this schizophrenic split doesn't have to be. That what we are trying to do here and in other communities is much more universal than this keen, competitive, aggressive behavior, which is really an invention of the last 2 years. This invention of free... capitalist economic free enterprise system, which can be traced not to any laws of nature, but to specific pieces of legislation within 18th and 19th century England. We have historically invented certain institutions, which we have imposed on society, and then tried to evolve various ideologies and philosophies, justify them, and then subverted entire system of education, and subverted and somehow brainwashed all our students, ourselves, including your professors, because they are the chief villains and main enemies. They have really screwed up your education and your thinking and your perception. And then we are complaining that things are not working. And then we have to redo the whole thing and then start with new assumptions again. I am not giving you any easy road to truth or known to stars. The road to truth is always thorny, and a road to star is impossible, but you have to follow it. Or to summarize what I am really saying by words of Walt. What is the name? Go on. Well, this chasm is so vast because we have evolved the whole system of education supporting wrong myths. And I've spent a number of years being educated or being brainwashed by philosophers, and I can see how philosophy departments operate. The best ones are the worst, in a sense, because they really carry on this gospel of objectivity, of analytical detachment, of cutting all propositions to the extreme, and to be really best in their trade is to forget that you have a heart, you have feelings, you have guts. You are an abstract brain, and your great achievement is to be able to outdo your masters in analyzing propositions with ever new scrutiny. And as the result, there is a very curious kind of mind that comes. And this kind of mind will go to educate other kinds of minds. It is really a kind of ruthless analytical scrutiny which impinges on the entire being of persons. And this is, you know, only in the field I know best. But the same kind of scrutiny goes all the time. So we should not think that the reversal will be easy, for we are up against the whole system of education, which is entire culture that has brainwashed itself and now wants to perpetuate itself. For no institution really relinquishes its power, even if it knows that it is bankrupt, without trying to drag everything with it. Fortunately enough, there is enough alternative enclaves, but the battle is really in your minds and your hearts, and I think that by this token, Ken Schneider is right, that it's revolutionary, but there is no way that you can really have a ready-made alternative world for you. For as I was starting to say, Walt Whitman, no I, nor anyone else can travel that road for you. You must travel it yourself. However, if there is enough of us that want to travel this alternative road, by the courage and determination, we'll be able to get others, because the other paradigm is rolling on with great force, but people are not happy in being in it. I think that this is one of the remarkable signs of our times, that although we are the most affluent of all societies, we are one of the most miserable and unhappy of all societies. For we have proved beyond any reasonable doubt that affluence doesn't provide happiness, that the consumption of energy is not a quality of life. And consequently, people, even in nice suburbia, are looking for alternatives. And it will be up to you to show them how to live an alternative life, and with it, evolve alternative assumptions. My bit is to try to analyze for you and others and myself how really contingent, that is not necessary, how really coincidental are the assumptions on which our civilization and culture rests. This is all the invention of men of genius, admittedly, of the 17th, 18th, and 19th century. They have rethought the whole universe. We thought at first for good, for benefit of us all. Actually, their dreams were too narrow and they are backfiring. But they show that the whole heritage of a culture can be redone, because the heritage of medieval culture was really great. And they turn it around by their genius. But we now know that it was really a sheer kind of imagination power that they imposed on us. And now it is up to our sheer imagination, power, and genius to turn around again the scene and again, as I said, start treating ourselves as we ought to be, not as we are. Let's go and gaze at the stars. I didn't know that Master Soleri was here, otherwise I would not have finished without asking him to say the final word.
I'm busy.
The syndrome of the decayed civilization, being busy.